Networking for many years, networking with a lot of people. And before I had a coach, before my business coach, I had no idea. If you asked me 2 years ago, how many people do you network with? I would have absolutely no idea. I would say, yeah, maybe 50 people a month. Now I have my KPI spreadsheets where I have how many people did I network with? How many one-on-ones did I have? How many podcasts did I have? How many podcasts did I record? How many times did I speak with a reporter and all of this stuff? And then, of course, how many the output. So that's the input. And the output is how many Google Analytics, how many people visited our website, and how many ultimately, how many clients did we get from that, and how much revenue.
I love that you track your KPIs.
I network with about 250 people a month, and I have on average 35 one-on-ones.
Welcome to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for micropreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. I'm your host, Candice Ridardi, and today I'm joined by Tina Larson. Tina is the powerhouse behind the Folsom Group, New York City's leading co-op and condo business consultancy. She is also the author of Living the High Life, How Smart Co-op and Condo Owners Protect Themselves and Their Investment. Her firm works with boards, owners, and shareholders on their environmental, social, and governance-related matters to reduce costs and increase property values. Tina holds a LEED Green Associate designation and is on a mission to make New York safer, more sustainable, and more affordable, one building at a time. Prior to this, Tina spent two decades as a business analyst and investment advisor in the financial services industry. She holds a BS and an MBA from Pace University. Welcome, Tina.
Thank you so much, Candace, for having me.
This is going to be a very interesting conversation because I really admire your narrow niche. I mean, you have a narrow niche. So before we
it
get
is
into
a narrow niche.
Before we get into that, tell us your story. How did you get to where you are today?
Oh, it's a funny story because it was by accident. So I come from a finance background and I was analyzing multi-billion dollar companies for the purpose of investing my clients' money or our clients' money. In doing that, I was analyzing all kinds of numbers, right? What's the best investment? We bought a co-op. In our co-op, after a few years living there, we went like, why is the maintenance increasing so much every year when there's no inflation and when they're saying that the increase is only to cover the increasing cost? It was increasing at 5% per year for the last 10 years. So we went like, this doesn't even make sense. What service providers always increase their fees by 10%? So we held a coup. We spoke with some of our neighbors. Yeah, very exciting. We spoke with some of our neighbors who felt the same way. And we all got together and we organized a coup, took over the board. And for full disclosure, I'm not on the board. My husband is the board, he's on the board, and he's now the board president. But what happens is that you can only be one board member from each department. So I couldn't be on the board, and we made a decision. And he's more diplomatic, shall we say? But the new board asked me, because of my analytical background, if I could find some savings. So I went out. I get the financial statements from other buildings. I pretended to be a buyer. Probably our real estate friends probably don't like that too much, but. And once I had enough data, we made some phone calls, eliminated some services, renegotiated some contracts, and we were able to save our building in the first 3 years, $340,000. Yes.
Holy moly, guacamole. Okay,
yes.
So how did that lead to your business?
So when I was out networking, you know how much everybody wants to meet another financial advisor? No, no. So when I, instead of introducing myself as what I did for as a profession, I introduced myself as I helped my co-op save $340,000. One third of New Yorkers live in a co-op or a condo. Okay, so I walk into a room of 100 people, 30 of them on average should live in a co-op or condo. And a lot of people, they said to me, oh, can I introduce you to my board? And we started our business. We said, well, if there were that many people who want to introduce us. Why not?
So basically, your expertise led to a need that led to a business. Yes. And you didn't even know the need existed.
That's correct.
So do you know the number off the top of your head, how much money you've saved co-ops over? Do you know the number?
I did not have the exact number. In the beginning, I did. It's millions and millions of dollars.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then you wrote a book, Living the High Life.
I did that last year. I had been kind of collecting information in my head. And so in 2020, I had been talking about hiring coaches for the longest time, and I never did anything about it. In 2019, I was close to hiring a coach. I didn't find the right coaches. And then in March of 2020, when we all had to stay at home, I went like, well, it's not like I have to be anywhere else. So I found a business coach, and the first thing that she said, you need to be more active on LinkedIn. And I said, how do I do that? And she said, find someone who knows LinkedIn. So I hired a LinkedIn coach who told me that I needed to be on video. And then that led to me hiring a speaking coach because I was terrified of being on video. And I had all these coaches, and they all said that they wanted me to be out speaking more. And then someone said, oh, it's always better to go out speaking when you have a book. So I wrote a book.
So one thing, this is a case of one thing leading to another, leading to another, leading to another. So talk about your book. Who's your book for?
The book is for anyone who lives in an HOA.
Okay.
It does address a lot of New York centric issue that only happens in apartment buildings in New York, Florida, Chicago. But it also, there's a lot of tips and a lot of takeaways that can be for anyone living in an HOA.
Yeah. And from my personal experience, living in an HOA can be very frustrating. Because some of them have too much power. But it can also be rewarding, because sometimes HOAs are good. And I think it has to do with who is running it. I mean, who's on the board? So, you know, if you don't, I always believe if you don't like the way things are run, take over. You know?
Yes.
Get involved.
And that is what the book is about. The book is about how to get involved, how to organize to do that. Where do you start? And the different laws, there are bylaws and all the house rules and the governing documents of the HOA or co-op or condo. And so it's a primer on it. In my person, now I'm a little biased, but in my personal opinion, anyone who lives in an HOA and don't understand how it works or would like to know how it works, this is a great guide for that.
Awesome.
But I'm a little biased.
Well, I do not live in an HOA now. Right now, I live in a downtown area. The city owns everything, and it's different.
Yeah.
It's different. It's a little harder to get the neighbors to clean up their yards.
Yeah. I mean, we feel that people who rent in rental communities, there's less involvement. Whereas if you own, then you become pickier because it's your investment.
Well, so what I have learned from living in this, I live in a community that at one time wasn't doing so hot, but has now had a resurgence and a major comeback. And, you know, I live three houses away from $1 million properties and three houses away from $100,000 properties, right? So it's a very interesting neighborhood. But what I've learned is that the landlords, the folks that have owned the property for 20 or more years, they don't understand what's happening to the neighborhood, and they're not keeping up. So they're being left behind, and they're leaving money on the table. I mean, to be honest, they're leaving money on the table. If they're going to continue to be slumlords, they are leaving money on the table. They could raise their rent by four times and have much better renters. And all they have to do is invest, you know, $25,000, $30,000, fix up their place and keep it clean, right?
Yeah.
But they're leaving money on their table because they don't understand what's happening in the neighborhood. And I'm not in a gentrified area. The area I live in has always been weird. It's always had the $1 million houses and the $100,000 houses. It's been cleaned up a lot in the last 10 years because the community's had a resurgence. You know, that it was really depressed here, and now it's had a comeback. You know, it's got new leadership, and the new leadership sees the direction that it needs to go. So, you know, it makes me feel sad for the people who live in the houses that are not being well cared for. And it makes the neighborhood look terrible because you have everybody else, you know, even some landlords who are rental properties understand what they have and are keeping up. And then they're the ones that just haven't, they live out of state or they live out of town and they haven't driven through the neighborhood and they don't realize what they have.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's very common. And it's very common in co-ops and condos too. So it's not, and I mean, think about it. In New York City, most people live next to a building where it's not well maintained. And then they live next to, and on the other side, they have a luxury building where things are very different. So it's not, it's more common than you would think.
Well, and also when you live in a community that's as old as New York City and as old as the Muskegon where I live, the street that I lived in, that I live on, they just resurfaced it. They dug it down to the bottom and they dug up the cobblestones. I mean, they had just been layering asphalt and concrete on top of the cobblestones, but they dug down to the bottom. The original road was still there. It was deep. It was like 2 feet down there, but you know, it's a 150-year-old road and it's still there. And they replaced our pipes that were over 100 years old. I'm telling you, this neighborhood is in a resurgence and a comeback. And it's kind of exciting, you know, and I think that when you live in places that are old, like, I mean, New York City is four or 500 years old. So there may be buildings there that are a couple hundred years old that are just sitting next to houses that were built 20 years ago. So,
Then you can only imagine when Con Edison has to dig up the road or they have to repair the water pipe, the main water pipe. I mean, they're completely corroded. They're so old. And Con Edison has been on my corner. I'm on a street. I'm in the middle of a huge intersection. And every time we turn around, Con Edison is out there digging up the asphalt again because they need to fix something.
You think that
Or Verizon.
I wish that the internet company would fix lines. Anyway, I want to talk to you about your addiction to coaching. It's not an addiction. I don't think I know anybody who has more coaches than you have. And you actually introduced me to somebody that I meet with on a regular basis, which is your native speaker coach, your language. What does she call it? Melanie,
Melanie Fox.
Dialect coach. Her dialect coach. That's it.
Accent reduction and dialect coach. She's amazing. And so when I moved here, I moved to New York from Sweden in 1994. And at the time, my English was school English, right? And I was surrounded by people who were very, who cared for me. And they helped me improve my language and and reduce my accent. But they're just, you know, it was my boyfriend at the time, my husband now. And it was the receptionist at the company that I worked for and my mentor, my boss. They helped me. I said to them, I said, listen, if I say something grammatically incorrect, you need to help me. So I've been surrounded by people who have helped me. But not until I met Melanie, she helped me practice certain sounds that I was like, and that's exactly what it feels like me saying it. And so she helped me tremendously. But then in 2020, when I was on video and Alexa couldn't even figure out what I was saying, that's when I started improving even more. And this is where we left with a little bit of an accent. But
You hardly have any accent at all. And you live in New York. So, you know, it could be anything. So I remember taking third year French and we went beyond the basics from, you know, just learning what the words are and being able to identify them and yada, 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 to actually practicing how to form the sounds with our mouth. And by the time that hour was over, our jaws would be sore because different languages require different muscles in your mouth. And sorry, Americans, we have lazy mouths. We really do. We don't pronounce our words the way that Europeans pronounce. I mean, I'm sure that you had to really soften your jawline when you were speaking English.
I didn't think of it. I mean, Melanie took care of it. Whatever Melanie told me to do, I did.
Oh, I just remember after French class to start. Oh, you know, and we would just pronounce vowels over and over again with our jaws in the right position. And you know, or our mouths open or closed, or, you know, that, you know, I've never been able to learn Spanish because I can't roll my R's. I mean, can you imagine taking a Spanish class where you're just rolling your R's, how your mouth must feel after that? But when you speak the language natively, you're used to it, right?
Yeah.
Right. So, then you have Meredith, who is your video coach, who I've interviewed on this show and I adore. And that's how you and I met. And then you have, you have your business coach. So you have your business coach, your video coach, your dialect coach, and your LinkedIn coach.
Yeah.
So talk to me about how they all work together. Cause a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, how can you have that many coaches? So talk to me about how they all work together to help you and support you.
So they all have a very specific purpose, but they all help together, right? So the business coach is here to help us brand, market, personal brand, et cetera. The LinkedIn coach, I initially hired him to help us come up with a LinkedIn strategy and to be more active on LinkedIn. So I have a very defined strategy on how to operate on LinkedIn. I spend half an hour in the morning and half an hour in the late afternoon on LinkedIn every day. Well, 5 days a week, and then a little bit extra on the weekends, but 5 days a week. And that's very specific. But he too has taken a lot of coaching courses. So he took Tony Robbins and all of my coaches. They've all taken Tony Robbins and many other coaches. And some of them have done that. Have you ever heard of Landmark? Landmark, is that what it's called?
No.
It's like a very intense weekend where you dig into why you can't move forward.
Is that the walking on the hot coals weekend?
Yes,
I think so. But
they've all taken all of these coaching programs, and now I'm the beneficiary of them doing that, right? Because they have learned and then they have perfected their coaching style according to what they have learned from other coaches. And then Meredith is just fantastic. I have to tell you that if anyone told me a year ago that I would be able to do a 15-minute speech, which I held for my book launch party, and I would be able to memorize the whole thing, and I would be 100% confident and even have fun while doing it, I would have told you no. I started with her. I have been in her improv class for 2 years, and it's a weekly improv class. So I practiced with her, but then I hired her in the beginning of August last year for my November launch. And I worked one-on-one with her. And even in October, so I worked with her August, September, October. If you told me in October or 2 days before my speech, I would have said, ain't going to happen. She is truly amazing.
Wow. A link to that interview with Meredith will be in the show notes. She's pretty fun. So when you were taking improv from her, was it improv for comedy or improv for sales?
For building confidence.
Improv for confidence. I love what improv can do. I mean, people think about improv as whose line is it anyway, but there are so many layers to what improv can do. And I love people who are actually taking improv so they can become better sales people. Because you got to react. The yes and takes you everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's a big proponent of yes and.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the improv has also helped me realize certain things like yes and. And to be more positive. All my coaches have helped me to become more positive. And I always thought to myself as a positive person, but apparently when you retrospect, probably not so much.
So you've got the four coaches, you've got the book, you've got this practice that fell into your lap because you didn't know that people needed it until you did it. And everything sort of works together beautifully. What I love is that there's so many different niches for coaching. Like my niche is really narrow too. I help female solopreneurs who've had something really crappy happen to them with their business. It's a really narrow niche. Yes, your niche is co-ops. I mean, that's a really narrow co-op. Their co-ops exist in a handful of cities, right? You know, so it's a really narrow niche. You've got a public speaking coach, you know, who helps you with your video. You've got a LinkedIn coach. You've got a dialect reduction coach. Those are really narrow niches. So talk to me about that.
Yeah. And my LinkedIn coach, he has been coaching AI for since the AI came out.
Oh, and that's a whole new, you know.
So he's now, I also added, so he is my AI trainer.
I love it. I've been teaching a lot of AI too. I'm an early adopter, I figured things out and I learn from other people, and people want to know, and they want to know where the best places are and what to do. And, you know, I'm only digging into AI to help write. AI art and all that isn't, but you want to outline a good blog post? I'll teach you how to outline it so that it doesn't sound like AI wrote it, Anyway, go on.
Yeah, but the AI, I have to say that it's become so, I started using it, I would say that December last year. And so my LinkedIn coach called me up and he said, listen, I know that you're always open to new ideas and new things. He said, I have something I have to share with you. He said, it's going to blow your mind. And he showed me, so we did it over Zoom so that he could show me how it would work. And I started using it, and we're using it actively for our business in all kinds, in writing video scripts, I mean, for everything. And I have to say, in the last month, ChatGPT has really become much better. But it's also, I think that it's also because I use ChatGPT every day. I use Bing and all of those also, but I use ChatGPT every day. And I think that because I have created so much content, it's learned my voice and it's learned what I write about. So now I don't even have to say Manhattan Co-op. I just say, write a post for me today. And it already knows my tone, what I talk about, my topics, what I want to do, how I want to structure it, that I want to end with a question. And it already has learned all of this. And I think that it's because I've used it so much.
And that's, you've got the paid version of ChatGPT, the version 4? No?
No.
You just have the free version?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
ChatGPT hasn't learned my voice at all.
Really?
Yeah.
But I don't know. But I don't, do you think?
But you know what? A lot of that might be because I use it also to teach. And so oftentimes I'm teaching and I'll use somebody else as the example when I do my prompts. So I'll say act like, and then I'll describe the other person. So maybe ChatGPT just doesn't know who I am. But I like Bard better. I think Bard writes better.
Yes, it's very good too. And Bing is very good too. But now, do you delete? So if I show someone, and I show people all the time about ChatGPT because I think that it's so fantastic that I want to share what I've learned.
Oh,
but if I write, so let's say that I write a recommendation about you, Candace.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll go into your LinkedIn profile and I'll copy your about section and I'll put it in there and say, write the recommendation for Candace based on my experience working with her. So it will write that for me and then I'll revise it however I want to revise it. And then I delete that.
Because it's about me and not you. Smart. And I don't think I'm doing that. I think I'm saving everything.
Yeah, so no, I delete when it's for everyone else. I'll be happy to use it and write it and show and tell, but I always delete those.
There's a prompting there for me to update my LinkedIn bio because I haven't updated it in a while and I know it's not accurate or up to date. But I learned recently that as much as I didn't want it to be the platform where I hang out and where I find clients, that Facebook is my platform. Since I went back to Facebook, I've added 3 clients and I have a free class that I teach on the first Thursday of the month. And I've got 6 new people registered for that have never registered for an event before. So Facebook is where I need to be. I mean, and you need to learn as a marketer, you do need to learn where your audience is. And I resisted my audience being on Facebook for so long because I just didn't like the platform. But that's where they are. So I have to get over it and get better at filtering out the people's posts that I don't want to see. And, you know, nobody knows when you unfriend them. So unfriend, you know, as necessary so that you're only seeing posts from people that you want to see the posts from. And I also discovered a plugin, and I think it's called Newsfeed Eradicator. It's a Chrome extension So the feed, when I go to Facebook now, I don't see the feed unless I turn off the eradicator. So I can turn on the feed for 10 or 15 minutes so I can read it. And then when I come back to Facebook later to post a reel or whatever, or upload something, I'm not going to be sucked into the feed. Because a lot of it was that my heart was breaking because of people's posts about stuff that just was so contrary to my belief system, you know? And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe these people that I know and like are such heathens, right? You know? And but I also think that people put stuff on social media that they might not say in real life, right?
I know. It's crazy. It's crazy. But I feel that it's less so on LinkedIn. And I think that that's because they're thought of as the professional side. So if they say something, so let's say something political or religious, they might say something like that on Facebook, whereas probably not on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
So I feel that LinkedIn is cleaner.
Yeah. Because, well, yeah. It's also a different people hang out on LinkedIn than hang out on Facebook, or I mean, it's completely different people who hang out on Instagram, even though Facebook and Instagram are owned by the same folks. Instagram is way different than Facebook, and Threads is way different than Instagram and Facebook. Right. And they're all owned by Meta. But, you know, my husband likes Threads and I can't stand it. Right. I don't like Threads at all. I was on there for like 3 days. And I'm like, I'm done with this. I'm not doing this anymore. You know,
but what I did was that I created a profile and I said, I'm more active on LinkedIn. Check me out here.
Perfect.
So
perfect.
I did create an account, but I'm not very active. And then I'm just directing them to LinkedIn.
That's smart. That's super smart. Tell people where to find you in the place that you want to be found.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I use that Linktree or whatever it's called, where they can find me everywhere.
Yeah. That's perfect. That's perfect. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you were going to mention something else about coaching and we went down a well. So what was the other thing you're going to mention?
Yeah, no, I think that all the coaches, they all have the same, even if they have very specific niches that they work in, they all have the same goal, right? And that's to make me and my business excel.
And that's your goal. Their goal should
that's
be your
my goal.
And what I love about working with different coaches is that you learn from their style and you learn what works, what may have worked well for you with them. And then you can take those ideas and those, you know, those styles and use them with your clients. I mean, you're coaching condo associations. You're not coaching an individual person. You're speaking in front of groups. Tell me what you do on a day-to-day basis. I have an assumption of what I think you do, but let's hear
so
from you.
We're not. So number one, we're not coaches per se. We're not. We're consultants. So I don't have a coach certificate or anything.
Most coaches don't.
Okay. I didn't realize that. But we do very much coach stuff that we actually implement. So what we do on an everyday basis is that we, number one, we look for to reduce their expenses. So we analyze their financial statements and all of their service contracts. And then whenever the service contracts are up for renewal, we renegotiate them. We bring in alternative vendors and bring down the cost of each service contract.
Wow.
And the same for all of their projects. So they need a new roof, or they have a leak, or they need a new elevator, and they need to inspect their facades. We reduce how much they pay for all of those upgrades. And right now, there's the Local Law 97 in New York City. It's the law where New York City is trying to become, or trying, their goal is to become carbon neutral by 2050. So right now we're working very actively on a lot of energy upgrades to reduce the carbon. So those are that's one of the day-to-day aspects of what we do. Another aspect is that 9 out of 10 times when we speak with a new board, they tell us that they are not as supported as they would like by their property manager.
Mm.
So we have a property management paint service where we will do the entire RFP. We'll have a discovery call with them and say, what is it that you hate about your current situation? And what is that you absolutely need in your next property management firm? And then it's kind of like, love it. Have you ever seen the HGTV Love It or List It?
No, but it's like that process.
It's the same process. And then we will create an RFP based on their needs, and we will send it out depending on their size, their location, their needs. We will send this RFP out to some property management firms that we think are good fit for them. And then we will handle the bidding process and the interview process. We'll have a pre-interview with them to double check and to make sure that they understand what the needs are. And then we'll schedule and hold the interviews on Zoom with the board, and then we'll help them make a decision, because very often they still have a hard time making a decision.
That's a huge, huge value. So this to me sounds like you have a huge network.
We do.
So talk to me about how you built your network.
Networking for many years, networking with a lot of people. And before I had a coach, before my business coach, I had no idea. If you asked me 2 years ago, how many people do you network with? I would have absolutely no idea. I would say, yeah, maybe 50 people a month. Now I have my KPI spreadsheets where I have how many people did I network with? How many one-on-ones did I have? How many podcasts did I record? How many times did I speak with a reporter, and all of this stuff? And then, of course, how many the output. So that's the input. And then the output is how many Google analytics, how many people visited our website, and how many clients did we get from that, and how much revenue.
I love that you track your KPIs. I love that. And
I started recently. So I was in the coaching program for a while before I actually started. I did have my LinkedIn coach. He said right away, he said, you need to track your LinkedIn activity. So I did that right away, but the KPIs for our business, I did not do. So I used it based on the December 2021. That was the baseline. So for 2022, I have the entire year, and now I have the entire year. I network with about 250 people a month, and I have on average 35 one-on-ones.
So 250 people, meaning that you go to different networking groups and there's about 250 people in the room when you go, different people. And then you have 35 one-to-ones, which is more than one a day. Wow. I average two one-to-ones a week and I'm exhausted. So you must be. That doesn't include podcast interviews though. You know what? Okay, so I want it for the audience. If you do not know what a KPI is, audience members, it's a key performance indicator. You have inputs and outputs. The inputs are the things that you can control, and the outputs are the results. You can't necessarily control the results. So what Tina was talking about is she can control how many times she networks, how many one-to-ones she has, how many interviews she has, how many, podcast episode appearances she makes. She can control that, but she cannot control the clicks on her website. But the clicks on her website will increase if she's doing all the things correct in the input side of it. Did I get that right, Tina?
Yes, you did. That's if I was a coach, that's exactly how I would have said
I got the concept down. Do I do it? I actually do track my one-to-ones. I do that.
You
I,
do.
yeah. I don't track all of my KPIs though. I probably should just to see, because it's I know that I have way too many podcast episodes recorded and that I should limit the number of podcast interviews I do every week or every month. But I didn't, and I have way too many in the queue right now. I am currently March 2024 is how far out I'm booked.
Wow.
So yeah, that's something that I need to control better.
But think about it. Your podcast, I mean, that's basically a one-on-one. So
Yeah, it is.
you're doing two things in one.
Yeah. And a lot of it, a lot of times I don't have an interview with somebody until I've met them and I know I want to interview them. So you and I have met before. And we've, now we have mutual friends because we've introduced each other to people. So, there's a know, like, and trust, and there's a rapport during the conversation. But sometimes I'm interviewing somebody I've never met before. I've never even seen their face, and I don't know. Sometimes those interviews do go well, but I think the conversation is better when there's a little bit of a rapport. Okay, so what else do you want to talk about?
Yeah, business, how sales.
Sales.
Yeah.
What's your insight into sales?
I think I need a sales coach.
You know, I right now my okay, so this episode is 2 months ago. For the listener's sake, 2 months ago, I was going through the one page marketing plan with my Robusta clients. That's my group coaching program. And so the one page marketing plan was written by Alan Dibb. It's one of my favorite marketing books. It's probably my favorite marketing book. So, and it literally is it's 9 steps for the sales process. And so I'm just going through each of the steps with the Robusta group. You know, every week we focus on another step. And something that I had forgotten about was how a lot of us give people too many choices. So if you want to sell more, reduce the number of choices, which is why it's so important to niche, right? Your niche is that you are a co-op and condo consultant. You work with co-ops and condo associations, right? Yeah. Really narrow niche. And you can even narrow that down even more, right? Condo associations that have 300 or more units, or, you know, you can really narrow that down. And so when somebody starts a business and they want to be the hair supplier for everybody, they're not going to do as well as if they figured out, okay, I want to be the hair supplier for bald people. I know that sounds silly, but you know, I want to provide products for bald people, right? That business is going to do better because they've narrowed their product offering real small. And there was actually a study, and I wish I could quote it, but it will be in the show notes because I did find it. But there was a study done at a farmer's market. A jam vendor put out 24 flavors, sampled all the flavors. On average, people passing by sampled 2 flavors. And then the next week they put out 6 flavors and they sampled all the flavors. And on average, the people sampled 2 flavors. Do you want to know when they sold more jam? By 10 times. They sold 10 times more jam. 10 times more jars of jam were sold when they only had 6 flavors available.
That's amazing.
10 times.
And I went to a Vistage. Have you ever been to a Vistage group? I went to a Vistage group recently. It's a CEO peer group. It's not networking. It's really a peer group where you learn from other people in the same.
So Vistage is the name of the organization? Vistage?
Yes.
Okay.
And I was invited to one of those. And there was a guy who is, he's not a salesperson, but he understands. Oh, he has a coaching business, but he has done market research. And that's actually my business coach. He comes from a market research and advertising background, which has been really helpful. But what he said was, and he had some kind of studies, and I don't know the exact statistics. He said, if you give them one option, so if you send an agreement and you give them one option, this is their proposal, you have one option, then they're picking between your option and some other firm's option. He said, if instead you have 3 different options, then they're choosing between your 3 and they don't care about the other one. And I was like, that is so fascinating.
I agree with that as well. My husband is a proponent of always get 3 quotes. So when we need the roof fixed or, you know, yard work done or whatever, always says get 3 quotes. But so 3 is a magic number. So if you provide a proposal for somebody and say, here are your 3 options, and 3 really is a really, 3 is a magical number. Like I always tell people when they're doing their 10-minute B&I presentation, to do 3 points, 3 reasons why you need to be a B&I member. You know, I have an upcoming B&I presentation. It's 3 ways to overcome stress as a solopreneur, right? So just 3 is a magic number because it's 10 minutes. You can talk about each point for a couple minutes and then you have your intro and your outro, right? So 3 is a really magic number. And I love this idea of, okay, here's option 1, option 2, option 3, because then they don't need to look at the other options. Nope. The other thing about when you do a proposal is to make sure that you give all the information that they need to make the decision. There is a painter that I met once, and he will itemize exactly everything that he will do, from cleanup lay down the you know, we're going to lay down plastic so that we don't step on your stuff. After we're done, we're going to clean up everything and make sure everything is removed from the premises. He puts all that on the contract, as opposed to single line item, paint your house, you know, $5,000. And then he itemizes everything so that you know exactly what to expect. And so that's why he wins contracts too, because people know what to expect from him.
But at the same time, so when it comes to construction, sometimes I feel that, so we were just renegotiating for one of our clients, three lighting upgrades. So they had three lighting upgrades. The lowest bid was $38,000. And then there were two bids that were between $100,000 and $110,000. And then there was one bid that was $150,000. They had four bids actually. So the 150 they discarded and they said, we're not doing that one. But to make a decision between 38 and 100, around 100, it's a huge decision. So you really have to take a look at that. And it turned out that the two firms that had approximately 100,000 on their proposal, they had just like your proposal, your painter was talking about, they had everything lined up. Everything, all the details were there. Whereas the 38,000, it was a very simple. This is what it is, and here it's $38,000, and very few details. Now, because we're paid on as a percentage of savings, so they had discarded the 38,000 because they said it doesn't even say what it is, and all we did was call the guy up and say, we need to know exactly what you're doing. And it turned out that they performed exactly the same services, only it was not in the contract. And that's where we are like, well, if this is a contractor, do you really expect them to specialize in creating a good contract? Or do you have to put a little trust out there? So we confirmed that he actually was going to perform all the fancy stuff that was listed on the higher bidder. But because he confirmed it with us verbally, we now can go to our clients and say, we recommend that you take the $38,000 quote because it's a good quote and the same promise, only they're not as good at writing contracts or proposals.
So maybe the $38,000 bidder in the future understands how important it is to itemize on his contracts, or at least add some language that says includes installation, cleanup, yada, yada, yada. Because I mean, that is the most important thing. When you have a contractor coming to your home, you want to know that your house is going to look the way it did when they leave, that it's going to look the way it did when they got there, right? That they're not going to leave their trash. You want to know that. And if it doesn't itemize it on the contract, they're, you know, and you had to call and ask. So how many people actually are going to do that? So there's, I mean, I'm not saying to itemize it down to the nitty gritty, but you know, if you really are going to,
But we very often see that because they're contractors. I mean, they didn't take a coaching class in how to write a better proposal.
That's true. But a little feedback, maybe, you know, the next time they'll know better. You know, I've learned with, in our previous business where we made custom furniture, I learned to outline every detail, every single minuscule detail needed to be on that because it was a custom piece of furniture. And so to counteract getting the phone call that this isn't the color I ordered. Well, first of all, they got color samples so that they got the color that they ordered, but I just itemized everything so that they knew exactly what they were going to get. And also the shop knew what they were building, mm-hmm. right? Because, you know, at one point we had six people working for us. So everybody in the process needed to see the same piece of paper that said exactly what they were making, right? Because it went through a process. So, itemization is great, but I do understand that not everybody can do it. And just because it doesn't say it on the contract doesn't mean it's not going to happen.
Yeah. And I mean, if the board says that we need that in the contract, we'll send them and say, you need to add this, this, and this. And then that's very easy for them to copy and paste and just add it to win the contract. Will they use that the next time around?
Yeah.
That's the difference. I mean, they are contractors. I mean, we were a friend of mine is replacing his roof on his house. So we don't work with that. And he's a friend. So I helped him. And he had two bids that were $80,000 and one bid that was $20,000. And the $20,000 bid, it was handwritten and taken a picture of the handwritten proposal, and it was much, much lower. And I told him the only thing that I would be concerned about was ask him what his warranty is, because that was the only thing that really matters. I mean, it's a single family home, so it's not as important as presenting it to a board. But at the same time, the only thing that I saw what could be the discrepancy was the warranty. And he said, nope, he says that. So he called him up and they provided warranty. So.
We just hope, as a business coach, I hope that you take feedback from your potential clients and the clients that book you, and you think about that in the future.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh wow. Oh my gosh, Tina, we need to wrap up. So I probably know the answer to this question, but what is your favorite marketing tool, tip, or technique?
My favorite marketing tool,
tip, or technique. I'm a lazy American. I slur my words.
No, you do not. My favorite marketing tool is networking.
Yeah.
I mean, I really wish that I had learned networking in school.
You and, do it I mean, very well.
Thank you. I wish that I got it earlier and I didn't. And when I started networking, I would say 12, 13 years ago, I had a pit in my stomach. I saw it as I walk into a room full of strangers and I have to talk to these people. And then a couple of years into it, I went like, I can't do this anymore unless I change something. And someone said, oh, see it as you're walking into a room full of future friends. And I'm like, I can do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
do you do a lot of in-person face-to-face networking? See, I haven't done that since the pandemic. I went completely virtual and I'm at that point right now where I'm thinking maybe I should start in-person networking again. And I'm like, yeah. And then I got COVID recently. I'm like, okay, maybe not.
I am
an extroverted introvert.
I think we all are. Aren't we all? A little bit.
And I've gotten very comfortable with virtual networking.
Yeah. No, I meet in person. And I have met in person since I started networking in person in June of 2020. And I actually switched groups. So I used to belong to, just like you, I used to belong to a BNI group, and I was there for 7 years, and it was a fantastic, it was a very large group. I think we were close to 90 at the time before the pandemic. But they are 100% virtual. And in 2020, I found a networking group. And that was not the reason I switched. The reason I switched is because this particular group is very heavy in construction. So it's a local group. We meet in person and they have a lot of contractors, which is very good for me, not for me to receive business, but for me to use for our clients' service, that for our clients' needs. So I switched group and we have been meeting in person since 2021.
That's really important. You have to network with the people that will serve your audience. And if you are not meeting with the people who will serve your audience, then you need to find them. So I am a huge fan of BNI because it offers a lot of different venues. Since it went virtual, it offers a lot of different opportunities like speed networking and yada, yada, yada. So what I did was I started a nationwide business to business power team because I have a good number of clients in Canada. And, you know, so it's not, I should do a North America power team for, you know, BNI members in Canada. But the power team is fantastic because it brings people together from across, you know, from New York City to Los Angeles, I like to say, and we never know who's going to be there every week. Or every other week. And it has broadened the network of everybody involved because with the virtual world, with what, you know, with the services I provide, this isn't true for you because you are New York City Central. You need to have the contractors. You need to have all that. But with the services I provide, it doesn't matter where somebody is. No. I can refer someone in New York City to someone in Los Angeles and they can work together. Right. So I've just created little within the networking that I belong to, I've created what I need, right? I've created what I need, and it's been fantastic. And I am the number one referral pastor in my chapter, and I also have the most one-to-ones in my chapter. So, but it's because I, on purpose, am looking for to network with the people that I need to network with. And when that wasn't inside of my chapter, I decided to create it.
Yeah.
You know, so I have a chapter as my home team, and then I've created, you know, the away games, right? Yeah. I've created the away games.
No. Yeah, no, very, very impressive. And power teams are so important. I have a mastermind group that I meet with on a regular basis with like-minded people that I've set up. So,
And you've also did something really cool is you created a LinkedIn comment pod, which is I'd never even heard of before I met you. So that's something you did that's really cool too.
That's from my LinkedIn coach. I would have never done it. But I have, and I'm in a lot of those pods.
Yeah. What they're called, they're not called comment pods. They're called something else.
Discuss- messenger, group messenger.
Yeah. LinkedIn pods or whatever, which is a completely another conversation. Can't have that conversation now. Ooh, holding the audience in suspense.
Yes.
I love it. All right. This is your moment of gratitude. For whom or what are you most grateful?
I am grateful for my husband, who is 100% supportive of all my crazy ideas.
Thanks for tuning in to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for micropreneurs, building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Audible, iTunes, Good Pods, or your preferred podcast player. Our theme music is Track 14 by Rev Brock and Soul Lily. Make sure to visit gratitudegeek.com for the show notes, where you can find links to all the groovy resources we've mentioned, including ways to connect with our guest, Tina Larson. Stay groovy, my friends.
Stay groovy, my friends.